What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Palestinians hailed the UN top right body's decision to launch a probe into crimes committed during the recent Israeli onslaught on Gaza. Russia says the U.S. decision not to rejoin the Open Skies Arms Control Treaty is another political mistake that inflicts a new blow on the European security system. An official data shows France, the Eurozone's second largest economy, fell into recession in the first quarter of 2021 amid the coronavirus pandemic. The UN top rights body has agreed to launch an investigation into crimes committed during the recent Israeli onslaught on Gaza. Israel denounces the decision as shameful, while Palestinians welcome the move. This report brings you the details.
The decision has been made. The United Nations Human Rights Council has agreed to launch an open-ended international investigation into crimes committed during the 11-day Israeli onslaught on the Gaza Strip. The probe will also include the systematic abuses in the Palestinian territories and inside Israel. The resolution, which passed with 24 votes in favor in the 47-member council, will spur an unprecedented level of scrutiny on abuses and their root causes in the decades-long conflict. Israeli airstrikes and artillery fire on Gaza killed 255 Palestinians, including 66 children, and wounded more than 1,900 people in 11 days of conflict before a ceasefire. Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet voiced particular concern over, quote, the high level of civilian fatalities and injuries from the Israeli attacks on Gaza, and warned that they may constitute war crimes.
Israeli attacks resulted in extensive civilian deaths and injuries, as well as large-scale destruction and damage to civilian objects. These include governmental buildings, residential homes and apartment buildings, international humanitarian organizations, medical facilities, media offices, and roads connecting essential services such as hospitals.
The Palestinian Authority has welcomed the decision, saying it amounts to international recognition of Israel's systematic oppression and discrimination against the Palestinian people. The PA said this reality of apartheid and impunity can no longer be ignored. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has also hailed a UNHRC decision for investigation.
What happened in the Gaza Strip is a fully-fledged war crime that the world watched it happen on their television. Now we need a further step to be taken, which is to actually punish the occupation and take preventive steps so these crimes would not be repeated against our Palestinian people.
The United States, as Israel's number one supporter, has as usual regretted the Council's probe decision. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also criticized what he called a shameful example of the Council's blatant anti-Israeli obsession. Tel Aviv said that it will not cooperate with the probe. Analysts say the investigation comes at a time when a number of reports are emerging holding Israel responsible for crimes of apartheid and persecution.
This is really a paralegal type of impact because it's compounding against the Israelis, because it comes just in the wake of a couple of reports declaring Israel responsible for the crime of apartheid and the crime of persecution.
The Israeli regime is also under investigation in the International Criminal Court over 2014 war crimes in Gaza, settlement activities in the occupied West Bank, and the brutal crackdown on anti-occupation Palestinian protesters. Despite international condemnations and calls for investigations over the past decades, Israel has been enjoying the backing of the United States and other Western countries to commit crimes against Palestinians without fearing the consequences. Many, including Arab countries, have also been turning a blind eye to the crimes, and some have even made efforts to normalize ties with Tel Aviv. It remains to be seen whether the result of the investigation will change anything substantial on the ground.
Well, of course, we'll be discussing the different aspects of that story with the guests who join us for this special coverage. I have Mr. Sarbaz Ruhollah Rezvi. He's a peace activist and commentator who joins us via Skype out of the holy city of Qom in central Iran, as well as Honorable Saeb Shath. He's an author and Middle East affairs expert out of Belfast, Ireland, via Skype as well. Gentlemen, it's good to have you with us. We're going to begin with the reaction that Sarbaz Ruhollah Rezvi has to that latest development. Sarbaz.
Yeah, thank you. The decision that was taken by the Human Rights Commission of the United Nations has something really important in it. It is going to make and form a council which is a permanent council. So this is exactly the different point of this decision of Human Rights Commission, United Nations Human Rights Commission, that this commission is going to have a non-ended mandate to make probes on the possible war crimes being committed in the occupied lands of Palestine. So this is something new, for the first time taking place. 24 countries, 24 members agreed upon this decision. Meanwhile, 14 abstained and 9 who were against this decision. I believe that this achievement is again another victory for the Palestinians against the Zionist regime. So we had the defeat, we had the military defeat that took place throughout 11 days of the war, because the Zionists were not able to achieve their goals, and they were shocked by the reaction of the Palestinians, the resistance in Gaza, specifically speaking. The second point, which was a defeat for the Zionist regime, was the public opinion and the reaction of the people across the globe on social media, on the streets, from United States of America to UK, to all the Muslim and Arab countries. We observed a huge reaction, not only from the Muslims, but also from the Christian, Jews, seculars, from liberals from across the globe. They showed their reactions. It was at a level and at a magnitude that Israel had to push social media platforms such as Facebook and Twitter to remove the contents. So this was the second field, I believe, that was a victory. That was a victory for the Palestinian front. And the third one is now actually emerging. The United Nations Human Rights Commission is going to take a solid stand. And interestingly, Israel has rejected this idea, this probe. And meanwhile, the Palestinians, either Hamas or the Palestinian Administrative Investment, both have agreed upon and they have welcomed the decision taken by the Human Rights Commission of the United Nations. So this is, I do believe, another victory for the Palestinians. We should have a note. We should not forget the numbers in these 11 days of war. 252 people lost their lives on the Palestinian side and 13 people on the Israeli side. Among 252 people, it was based upon the announcement that was done by Yahya Sinwar, head of Hamas in Gaza. Only 80 people were belonging to the resistance forces or the military forces inside Gaza. But rest of them were civilians. It means 68% of the casualties in Gaza were civilians, out of which 66 were just kids, were just, innocent kids, out of which 39 were women, out of which 17 were plus 60 senior citizens of Palestine, who were all killed in the Israeli air attack and the attacks on Gaza. Some almost 70% of the casualties, 25% of the casualties were kids and were children. So this is an open human rights violation. It's an open and clear war crime. And I hope that this commission, this permanent commission is going to take a proper probe. And of course, Israelis have rejected any cooperation with this commission.
Sure.
Meanwhile, the Palestinians and also among them, Hamas has agreed upon.
Mm-hmm. Let me get some reaction from Saeb Shath as well. Sarbaz, I really appreciate it. Mr. Saeb Shath in Belfast, tell me what you think about the importance of this recent development happening at the UN regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
This is welcome. Resolution by United Nations Human Rights Council to launch an investigation into the unstoppable crimes it seems to be the Zionist entity commit against the Palestinians, and let's focus that the Palestinians are under violent colonial settler occupation. And this occupation's activity involved many layers of war and war crimes and crimes against humanity, from ethnic cleansing, which is committed even prior to 1948, till today. If we just see what was happening and is still ongoing in Jerusalem al-Quds, in Sheikh Jarrah, in Silwad, in areas they try to Judaize the city and put their hands in its holy Islamic and Christian site by cleansing all its Arabic and Palestinian inhabitants from it. The international community should heed, as your guest alluded to, the call of the people of the world who went out to the streets of all major cities in the world, calling for immediate steps to be taken to punish this Zionist criminal entity and to put a stop to its crimes. The UN Right Chief Michelle Bachelet, when she's expressed her concern over high level of civilian fatalities, as your guest detailed, and injuries by the from that Israeli attack on Gaza in the last the war of the 11 days, she stated that the Israeli aggression may constitute war crimes. This is a very important statement. And Michelle Bachelet stated as well that her office in the statement not seen evidence that the buildings hit by Israeli airstrikes, including medical facilities and media offices, were hosting any armed groups or being used for military purposes. Let me say that statement was backed because of the Al-Johara Tower, which was hit in Gaza, was hosting international media from France Press and all the Western media. This is where they got their information from. And these Westerners, journalists who were on the ground in Gaza and their offices being destroyed, they presented this information, you know, like there is nobody in this building and this tower except media. So there is an act of silencing the international media and keeping a blind eye, which supported by many Western countries, so the Israelis can keep their impunity. And according to the rest of the resolution text, the investigation will focus on establishing the facts and gather evidence. And that is the exactly facts and gathering evidence they want. They can see it from their own Western guys on the ground. Mm-hmm. This is an international, this kind of resolution is exactly as the Palestinian authority stated. It's a recognition of systematic oppression and discrimination against the Palestinian people. Mm-hmm. And if you may allow me, the U.S. and the Western, through its network of international community bodies and institutions such as the United Nations Security Council and other supranational bodies and organizations, keeps protecting this entity, a criminal regime, and provide it with impunity and keep arming it as well. As the United States of America stated, Biden himself, after the end of the last round of this 11 days, he's going to rearm the Zionists again and compensate them for the ammunition they use in Gaza.
Sarbaz Ruhollah Rezvi, peace activist and commentator out of the city of Qom in Iran. Mr. Saeb Shath, author and Middle East Affairs expert out of Belfast. Thank you very, very much for sharing your afternoon with us. Have a good day. A senior Iranian diplomat has condemned recent Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip, saying the regime's backers must be held accountable for deaths and destruction in the besieged territory. Iran's ambassador to Geneva-based international organizations, Ismail Baghaei Hamaneh, made the remarks during a special meeting of the UN Human Rights Council. Hamaneh said seeking justice for crimes committed against Palestinians must become the international community's immediate demand. He stressed that the only stable solution to the conflict is to hold a referendum with the participation of all Palestinian people. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has won a new 7-year term in office as President of the Syrian Arab Republic. Our correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, has the details.
The count of votes for Syria's presidential elections ended on Thursday after millions of Syrians cast their ballots on the 26th of May to choose one of the three presidential candidates as the nation's next leader. Speaker of Syria's People's Assembly, Hammoud Sabbagh, announced the final result in a press conference.
I am delighted and honored to announce the victory of Bashar Hafez al-Assad as the President of the Syrian Arab Republic. I express in the name of the Syrian People's Assembly our pride and appreciation and congratulations to our great Syrian people who voted for a free and great leader.
More than 13 million Syrians out of 14 million voted in favor of Assad. People filled the streets and main squares of major cities, celebrating what they say is a victory against all states that opposed the elections. Chanting slogans in support of President Bashar al-Assad, Syrians danced, sang, and expressed in all ways possible their feelings for their leader.
Western enemy countries' economic sanctions caused food and basic supply shortages in Syria, which forced Syrians to line up for hours at shop stores. Those countries today are definitely surprised to see those lines of people on the streets now expressing their love to President Assad and Syria. We will continue supporting Assad even if bread, water, food and gas are not available.
We are gathering today in all squares to tell all countries of the world that no country will defeat us, no matter how much plots they hatch. We are with Assad and we are steadfast. We all love President Assad.
Currently, Syrians' main demand is for President Assad to improve the economic situation in the country, which is suffering under harsh economic sanctions imposed unilaterally by the West and the United States. It's a historic moment in Syria, and Syrians have made that clear on the streets. They are celebrating victory over all states that wanted to forcibly topple the country's president for years, that they are the owners of this land and have the right to determine their country's future. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Russia says it is disappointed by the U.S. decision not to rejoin the Open Skies Arms Control Treaty. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov says the U.S. has made another political mistake, inflicting a new blow to the European security system. He added, however, that the U.S. decision does not create an atmosphere conducive to arms control discussions during an upcoming summit between the leaders of the two countries. Ryabkov was referring to next month's meeting between Russian President Vladimir Putin and his U.S. counterpart Joe Biden in Geneva. The U.S. State Department has cited Russia's failure to comply with the accord as the reason for not rejoining it, an allegation Moscow denies. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled his country out of the Open Skies Treaty that came into force in 2002. And that's it with international news.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Iran Today.
It takes less than a month to put a new face to the country. May the 11th saw presidential candidates registering with the Interior Ministry until May the 16th. And June the 18th will see ballots cast in Iran. Today we'll be looking at procedures filling the gap, the vetting of hopefuls, their election campaigns, where they come from, and what institutions have the clout to direct all the above into an acceptable future. I'm Leila Faromarzi. Presidential elections are held in Iran once every 4 years. The general process is that after the candidate's 5-day registration time frame with the Interior Ministry, their eligibility is reviewed within 10 days maximum by the constitutional vetting body known as the Guardian Council. This council has 12 members, 6 legal experts and 6 clerics. Any candidate winning at least 7 votes in favor is approved. Approved names are sent to the Interior Ministry. From the day names are finalized till 24 hours before election day, candidates can campaign. Elections are then held in a day with results to follow the next day. 592 people registered this year for the presidential race. After 10 days of vetting and consultations, the Guardian Council announced the approved candidates on May the 25th. The list is as follows. Ebrahim Raisi, Mohsen Rezai, Mohsen Mehralizadeh, Saeed Jalili, Ali Reza Zakani, Abdul Nasser Himmati, Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi. Now these candidates have 20 days to campaign for the presidential seat. Ms. Masuma Eftekar is current Vice President for Women and Family Affairs. We met her at the Vice Presidential Office for Women and Family Affairs.
We have always witnessed high voter turnout in Iran. Women and men have taken part in determining their future and destiny through elections. This is the strength of the Islamic Republic of Iran. But we've been facing a propaganda war against our country for the past several years now. This is part of the war waged against Iran, an economic war and a propaganda war. Our country has been facing fake news, a lot of slandering against the government.
Given JCPOA revival talks ongoing, one may expect a reformist hopeful to win the seat of president. Although many may be ready for a change of scene to principalist. But in Iran, election results have traditionally swung in favor of the dark horse or shadow candidate in the last few days running up to election day. Mr. Ghulam Reza Mesbahi Moghaddam is a former MP and Ayatollah, currently member to the Expediency Discernment Council and Assembly of Experts. We got to meet him at his office in Imam Sadegh University.
The events of 1997 showed us that when everybody believed Mr. Nader Nuri would win the ballots and that it wouldn't make a difference whether to vote or not, but we saw that it didn't happen. The candidate that garnered people's votes, Mr. Khatami, won the election with 20 million ballots against his rival with 7 million votes. Mr. Nader also congratulated Khatami on his victory. We have had this experience, and it can certainly happen again too.
خاتمی با 20 میلیون رای رقیب خودش رو با 7 میلیون رای کنار گذاشت.
Having mentioned JCPOA considerations with the turnout and vote, it's worth mentioning that nuclear deal is not Iran's only foreign policy factor for it to be a total determinant. With the JCPOA's failure to deliver, Iran struck a 25-year deal with China. Also, Iran is aware of a very partially exploited several hundred million strong regional market. Mr. Naghavi Hosseini is a former MP, well-versed with the law and eloquent in putting the country's political system into a legal and historical context. He gave us his time in a legal office of breathtaking elegance. He is currently a member of the Front of Islamic Revolution Stability.
The principalists are in luck. This is the reality. There is a tendency toward principalists in the society because reformists and moderates can't be accountable for Mr. Rouhani's performance. Even reformist figures like Mr. Aref try to depict Mr. Rouhani as a placeholder president who isn't a reformist. They are right, of course, because we have known Mr. Rouhani and he hasn't had a reformist background. But anyway, the cabinet has been the cabinet of the reformists. Many reformist ministers were in this cabinet. That's why principalists are now critical of the two past cabinets and hold people accountable who call themselves reformists.
Serious presidential candidates tend to formally register as candidates a few hours prior to deadline for a position that will see them preside over the highest strategic decision-making body, as well as the country itself. That's the Supreme National Security Council. The constitutionally mandated composition of the council also, however, awards a seat at the table to each power of the state, judiciary and legislative, as well as executive. Strategic cabinet ministers and the leader of the revolution or his representative also each have a vote. The president, as chief of the executive, governs how things are done to manage and steer the country. But that's not unsupervised and at times even vetoed. The Supreme National Security Council prevailing policy orientation will be the policy of the Iranian state, not necessarily policy preferences of the president.
Do comment on the leader's words, calling for a government that wants change. What would such a government look like?
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has always emphasized on people's participation, presence, role, criticism and protests. It's important to note that his view is that people must have a permanent and active presence. His second view is that there should always be a change. There has to be a turnover in the country's elites. That we shouldn't repeat the past. This is something to be noted. If the elections are held and the same people with a different form win, the same people who have been in office for the past 40 years, we can't expect any change to come about. People are looking for a government that would bring about profound changes.
More than 59 million of Iran's roughly 85 million population are eligible to vote. Under 1.5 million of whom are first-time voters. People may vote either way for economic reform. They may vote for a reformist with a greater tendency for diplomacy and international relations, or for a principalist who can provide cover for reformists to come to terms with the U.S. and West, Western partners to the JCPOA, so that sanctions can be lifted off this country. That is drawing on accounts by analysts abroad. Because looking at it from within Iran, the system is pretty unified on wanting talks to yield results, without, again, giving a mile to take an inch. The third scenario is that the turnout will be too low for reformists to stand a chance, looking at last year's parliamentary elections, whereby voter participation fell to 42%, a record low.
Plenty more to be said, but time to give others a chance for a word or two. So stay with me for a quick media review to see what other outlets have to say. And here it is in words. Shinhu Anet points to the conditions for candidacy, some of which the government had a problem with, for example, the optimum age group. World Insight, spotlight on heavyweights in Iran's presidential race as betting begins. To exclude a large number of the individuals who register every 4 years as potential candidates with very basic or no qualifications, the Guardian Council on May the 5th approved an amendment to further clarify the criteria based on which it vets the potential candidates, according to the Council's official website. Orf, who heads the Interior Ministry's election headquarters, said the lower number of registrants for this year's election compared to the previous votes has proven that the Council's move to clarify the criteria has been effective in bringing greater rationality to the registration process's general atmosphere, the IRNA wrote. In the 12th and 11th elections, the number of the registered hopefuls stood at 1,636 and 686, respectively, Orf said. According to the amended criteria, hopefuls must be between 40 and 70 years of age, hold at least a master's degree or its equivalent, have work experience of at least 4 years in managerial posts, and with no criminal record.
Analysts say the main chances of winning the vote could be of the principalist and reformist parties, the two main rival political camps in the country. Looking at oil price, would it make much difference to the U.S. really whether a reformist, a principalist, or moderate gets in with the Iranian presidential elections? The U.S. shouldn't hold high hopes for a pro-West Iranian president. The U.S. and Iran have been engaged in on-off talks about the resuscitation of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, the nuclear deal, for some months now, following the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the treaty in May 2018. So far, little progress has been made on any of the key issues involved on either side. There are hopes in some quarters of the U.S. State Department that this data, in conjunction with the election in Iran on 18th June of a new president, will result in a softening of Tehran's stance towards accepting the tougher clauses that Washington wants to include in any new nuclear deal. These hopes are likely to come to nothing, though. There are those Iranian politicians that believe that more engagement with the West will get Iran more of what it wants than more engagement with Russia and China, certainly. And there are questions of Iranian sovereignty attached to that, but that is not an ideological difference, just an economic one. But at the core, all Iranian top officials believe in the mottos of the Islamic Revolution of 1979, which are independence, freedom, and Islamic Republic. So although they might have different approaches toward Iran's problems, at the end of the day, they all have a deep distrust for the U.S. The Star points to a new development on social media in the run-up to the elections. Iranians find their voices on Clubhouse ahead of poll. As Iran gears up for a presidential election, people from across the political spectrum are taking to the audio app Clubhouse as a rare forum for debate inside the country. Chat rooms have been sprouting up every day on the invitation-only social media platform, some of them attracting thousands of listeners. Politicians from opposing factions have found their way to the app, along with an array of analysts, journalists, and Iranians, both at home and abroad. Clubhouse's main draw card is that it has created an opportunity for dialogue between people who could not bear talking to each other before, said Farid Modarresi, an analyst close to the moderate camp of incumbent President Hassan Rouhani. The hot topic on their lips has been the hopefuls who have been coming forward and registering to be candidates for the 18th June presidential election. In an editorial in April, the news agency Tasnim said Iran's foes could cause security, social, and political problems for the country through Clubhouse. In an interview with AFP, the Guardian Council's spokesman Abbas Ali Katkhodai said the body saw Clubhouse as potentially constructive as long as no crimes were committed. That will be it for the news segment, but do stay tuned. More coming up. There's been a face-off between the Guardian Council and the presidency over candidacy criteria. President Rouhani ordered his interior ministry to ignore the Guardian Council proclamation because he believes it has no legal authority to impose new, more restrictive qualifying criteria on candidates. But the council said it would refuse to consider candidates as formally registered if they fail to provide all required documents, including a lack of criminal record and no history of dissent. And the new criteria have, by the way, been backed by 200 Iranian parliamentarians. Although candidates here like to stress they are independent, there's political currents in the background which they are either akin to or which back them up. To introduce the main currents participating in this year's elections, they are the current critical of the Rouhani government, that's Raisi, etc., the current aligned with the government, and the current supportive of the Rouhani government, which is reformists. This is not to forget independents running for office.
In a religious democracy, the people's votes are really influential and decisive. You have witnessed in the past elections, for example, that the whole electoral system was being managed and administered by a political faction, but someone from a rival party won the election. For instance, in 2005, when all the administrative bodies were supportive of Mr. Hashemi Rafsanjani, but people voted for Mr. Ahmadinejad. The same happened in 2013. This is a matter of pride.
In Talking Democracy, Mr. Naghavi Hosseini said why it's so important for a system to run on working political parties. Because Iran has hundreds of parties, but how functioning they are is another matter.
The fact that the person is elected but doesn't make good on his words afterwards goes back to the problem of not having a parties-based political system, because the candidate hasn't been backed by a party to be held accountable after winning the vote. The U.S. Democrats are accountable for the president's performance because it was the party that collected the votes. The president has won as a Democrat, but because the principle of parties hasn't been established well in Iran, the candidate feels free to do whatever he wants after taking office as president. It's because there's no party to admonish him.
592 candidates, including 40 women, had registered by May the 19th. I asked what gave the 40 women the confidence to apply as prospective presidential candidates this year.
This is the culmination of a series of policies that we've implemented that has been successful in terms of engaging women in the decision-making processes in the country. We started the beginning of this government 8 years ago. About 5% of the managers in the government of the Islamic Republic of Iran were women. Although it's stipulated in the constitution that women have no, there's no obstacle to women's advancement, Imam Khomeini, the leader, have never made any obstacle for women's engagement in politics or in running the affairs of the country. But there have been glass ceilings. What President Rouhani did was that he put forward a strategy, particularly from 2017, that is his second government. He set a quota that 30% of the managers appointed in this government have to be women.
What tends to happen in Iran is that candidates on each front tend to pull out in favor of the winning card closest to their camp.
It's important that candidates from the two rival political camps compete, even if it doesn't result in polarity of votes. But people have to be able to prefer one over the other. There has to be a meaningful ground for preference. We can say one of the candidates is good, but the other is better. Or I can remember there was a time that we said one of the candidates was bad, but the other was worse. So we need to do something so he wouldn't take over. What I believe is crucial is that people understand that our current economic and social situation isn't acceptable at all. Especially over the past 8 years, things haven't been improving, but even regressing. Of course, both domestic and foreign factors were involved, but proper management makes a difference.
To what extent would you say political factions in Iran have reached political maturity, having seen four decades of the revolution go by?
Certainly, political movements have gained the necessary maturity after some 40 years of activity in Iran. There are some occasions when they face problems and doubts, but it's not because they're not mature enough. There are other reasons for that. The main one is the lack of parties. We don't have large and relatively inclusive parties. They're too small.
Talking of parties, under Article 26 of the Constitution of Iran, the formation of parties, societies, political or professional associations, as well as religious societies, is permitted, provided they do not violate the principles of independence, freedom, national unity, the criteria of Islam, or the basis of the Islamic Republic. In the early years following the 1979 Islamic Revolution, political parties in this country were divided into right-wing and left-wing, basically in the economic sense. Today, most parties can be classed as principalist or reformist. These are 1990s adaptations of right-wing and left-wing. Then there are moderates, the incumbent Rouhani government, and independents, basically speaking. To move on to ideology or political agenda, principalists say politics and religion are inseparable. They support a minimized government role in the economy to the extent mentioned in the Constitution. They view the globalization of economy with skepticism, while putting special emphasis on retaining independence from foreign countries. Reformists, on the other hand, seek to execute the constitutional rights of the people and work toward enhancing political freedom. They opt for a promotion of interaction with the international community. As for the term moderates, it surfaced in 2013 with Hassan Rouhani's presidential election. Moderates are widely believed to be left-leaning. They advocate employing diplomacy and refraining from using harsh rhetoric.
The other end of the spectrum are reformists who believe in the principles of the Islamic Revolution, abide to the Constitution, but are very forward-looking in their policies. And they believe that we have to have a progressive approach when dealing with Islam, because Islam is a religion for all times, and we have to engage in a dialogue which should be constructive but also can be critical dialogue with our young generation. To enable them to engage with the theoretical dimensions of the Islamic Revolution, to engage with some of the practical dimensions of what has happened all of these years. So this is what the reformists believe, and they believe that we need a constant reform of laws, of policy, of practices to be able to preserve the principles and the spirit of the Islamic Revolution.
A spectrum of political party colors being out there is no accident. Iran calls for diversity among candidates in upcoming presidential elections. But given this is a religious democracy in contrast to a Western liberal democracy with no title, I asked if that actually meant all walks of life in Iran will be covered by varied candidates and political parties.
It's always been like this. I mean, during elections in Iran, we've always had candidates from the two major political camps, the reformists and principalists. It would certainly be the case in the upcoming vote, too.
Can you compare political factions post-revolution to pre-revolution?
Political parties that were active before the revolution were Shah's puppets. We used to have the Iran Novin Party and the People's Party. Shah dissolved both and formed the Rastakhiz Party and called it the Single Party, saying to anyone who'd oppose it to take their passport, obtain the visa for another country and leave. There were no independent parties that relied on the people before the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution.
It's not just the 13th presidential elections the country will be holding on June the 18th, but the 6th election for the city and village councils, as well as midterm elections for the Islamic Consultative Assembly or Parliament. Also, the Assembly of Experts elections will be held on the same day in some provinces. Western political pundits, the media, politicians, frequently criticize this country for not being a democracy in their eyes. But not much is being said about authoritarian Arab kingdoms in the region. Why they can't see a democracy in common between religious democracy and Western liberal democracy calls for an answer.
Because they don't see their interests and their profits in the independence and the strength of the Islamic Republic. Because if the Islamic Republic of Iran proceeds as a successful model of an Islamic democracy in today's world, they're going to have a lot of problems with different entities which exist in the region, which are more or less dependent on Western governments for their economy or for their political system. They don't like to see a successful model of an independent state emerging.
That's it for today, but oh, the story is only just beginning. Bye.
As Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhis salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام من شقاء العيش ضيق المنزل
إمام الباقر عليه السلام stated a misfortunate way of life entails living in a cramped house.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam Baqir alayhi salam, in his conversations and his dialogues with his companions, with his friends, with his relatives, and even with the people in general, he did talk about a very great many things. One of the things that was discussed in these dialogues by Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam was talking about the rules of social conduct or the rules of Islamic etiquettes. It's very interesting, but Imam al-Baqir urged his companions to treat people according to a certain set of social conducts. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam in some of these conversations also warned the Muslims from having bad qualities, abominable qualities, if you will, qualities that are a detriment not only to the individual, but they are a detriment to society in general. Now, one of the things that Imam al-Baqir said when he was talking to his companions in this dialogue, Imam al-Baqir, peace and blessings upon him, said, "Setting right the one who does not know dignity is through disgracing him." Again, it's Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says that setting right the one who does not know dignity is through disgracing him. Now, here Imam al-Baqir talks about this thing when an individual, when a person, for example, you or I, when we don't understand the language of dignity, when we don't understand respect and honor and nobility, then the only way to get through a person is via being hard with them or being stern with them, being strict with them. And so, dear friends, I think here it's very interesting when we put it in the lens of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the exalted, the mighty. If we learn via dignity, if we learn via mercy, if we learn via forgiveness, then it is so much the better for us. For if we do not learn by means of mercy and forgiveness and leniency, then we will be taught via disgrace and humiliation and strictness and sternness and harshness. So really it comes back down to what we choose and what we want. Do we want to learn and correct our ways via dignity? Or do we want to learn and correct our ways through humiliation and disgrace? Interesting and beautiful words of wisdom in this dialogue by Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Attar, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I want you to listen to a shorter speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam.
The ilm of the Anbiya and Awliya, who they are, the Anbiya and the Darajat that exists among them. Yes, it says, لا نفرق بين أهدهم. But at the same time, we see these Darajat, the wisdoms that they have brought to mankind. Every prophet have brought a new type of wisdom and a new form of wisdom to the insaniyat, to the humanity. What wisdom they brought? The complexity of these prophets, why they are different? Why Khizr is different to Musa? Why Yusuf is different to Dawood? Why our prophet is Akmalul Anbiya? Right? The knowledge of the Ayatul Muhkamat, the knowledge of the Imams, who they are. In the du'as we recite, I always read this jumla. La farqa baynaka wa baynaha illa ibaduka wa khalquka. There is no difference between Allah and them, except that they are the ibaduka. They are the worshippers of Allah and they are the creation of God. Nauzubillah, we are not saying, it's very complex and very difficult to digest this. For those people who are not from the school of Ahl Bayt, they cannot digest this, I'm telling you. But there's a special love of wilayat God have given us, but we are not using it. Truly understand, the ma'rifat of Allah is the ma'rifat of the Imam-e Waqt. Imam is here. Ma'rifat has also been mentioned by the Imam, Ziyarat-e Jame Kabira. But are we really partaking in improving the ma'rifat of the Imam? Ayatul Muhkamat. This is the knowledge of the Imams. Antumul Awwal wa Antumul Akhir. Ziyarat-e Ali Yasin. To the Imam of the time. Huwa al-awwal, huwa al-akhir, huwa al-zahir, huwa al-batin. Antum al-awwal, antum al-akhir. But you're addressing the Imam like that. In Ziyarat Rajabiya, tafweez, the change of destiny is in your hands.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.